Blog Talk Radio.
What dear friendship I hail from, north or south, or from the east or west. My heart is filled with love for all of these. I only know I swell with pride and deep within my breast I thrill to see, O glory faint, the breeze. This is my country, land of my birth. This is my country, grandest on earth. I pledge my allegiance, America, the foe. For this is my country to have and to
show. We have a little problem we were going to, since it's a giant fever in San Francisco. We had a rare interview on how the Giants were lured to San Francisco, the New York, they were called the New York Giants in 1959. There's been some problem, I don't know what it is, but anyway, we'll try to resolve it. It's a great interview with California's greatest mayor, George Christopher. And we've run some interviews with, that we've done with him before, and they'll be up on our YouTube site as well. Anyway, some interesting birthdays today, and of course, our theme, we've settled on this theme, this is my country. And unfortunately, there are people who are trying to take it away from us, like George Soros. But today is the birthday of John Reed. John Reed was from Portland, Oregon, around the turn of the century, and those of you who remember the film Reds with he's the brother of Shirley MacLaine. John Reed was supposed to be, he was a communist, he was in the Russian Revolution, and he was he's the only foreigner who was buried in the Kremlin Wall. Now, I understand after the so-called fall of communism, a lot of people believe it was, that was a political feint. They removed Lenin's body. Lenin was preserved. He died, I think, of a heart attack in 1922, or in the 20s, and then Stalin pulled the stunts and eliminated all any opposition and any people who were aspiring to be numero uno. Anyway, they were supposed to have taken Lenin's body out of the air pressure, the hermetically sealed tomb, and we don't know what happened to it. I guess it does, it's become dust, as a lot of them. So we don't know what happened with John Reed's body. Anyway, a lot of birthdays today of famous actresses, and one is connected to the famous de Havilland Mosquito. It was a famous World War II fighter that the Royal Air Force used. Today's birthday of Joan Fontaine. She's pushing, I think she's in the early 90s, and her original name, she was born in Tokyo. Her father was a British patent attorney who was in Tokyo around 1915-1916. She is the sister of Olivia de Havilland. And so Joan Fontaine was originally, her birth was Olivia de Havilland Bouvier de Havilland. And then when she went on the stage as an actress, she's been married several times. One of them is to Brian Ahern. She took the name Joan Fontaine. Her sister is Olivia de Havilland. And there was this famous feud for years between the two. And there's also the birthday of the great Sarah Bernhardt. She was born today. Other actresses, Annette Funicello of The Mouseketeers. Those of us remember that program during the late 50s. Then there's Catherine Deneuve, the beautiful French woman. She was born today. And among the interesting deaths, this famous gangster, the FBI was, I think, on their list of public enemy number one or two, Pretty Boy Floyd in 1934. The FBI finally caught up with him and blew him away. Other birthdays today are Charles Glenn King. He's the guy that discovered vitamin C. And then the guy who discovered cosmic radio transmissions or emissions in 1932, his name was Carl Jansky. And then we have those of us who remember the hippie days and other cosmic events. Timothy Leary was born today, and those of you who don't know who he was, you had a degree from Harvard, and he invented LSD and apparently took too much of it, and many other people took too much of it. And there were several people who committed murders and other violence while under the influence of LSD. I've tried it, and I had cosmic experiences, but I wouldn't want to do it again. And then those of you who remember the PBS series, and we'll get into PBS and NPR, Derek Jacobi and I, Claudius, a great based on the book by a famous British author. And Derek Jacobi is gay, and he starred in a recent gay film. I forgot what it was. And let's see. Now, the interesting events today. Princeton got its charter, Princeton University, and this, I believe, is where Mrs. Obama, Michelle, went and supposedly did a thesis on racism, and nobody can look at it. Apparently, it's sealed. And today the, this is interesting because it relates to a murder trial that was just over in Belgium. In 1797, there was the first successful parachute jump in Paris by a guy named Jacques Guérin. In Belgium, the trial has just concluded, a murder trial involving a woman. She was parachute jumper with another woman, and they both loved the same man, and what she did was she sabotaged her competitor's parachute, and the woman jumped out of the plane, and the parachute didn't open, and she fell to the earth and was killed, and the accused said that didn't happen, but she was convicted today, and I think she was given 30 years sentence in a Belgian court. Excuse me. And then other events today, culturally, in 1893, the New York Metropolitan Opera in New York opened. The first opera was Faust, dealing with the devil. And then in politics in the 18th century, we had Sam Houston, the father of modern Texas. He was also the first president of the Republic of Texas. And then in 1938, all of us who thank God for copy machines, the first Xerox copy was made, successful. And then we have the continuing problem with Cuba. In 1962, JFK initiated a naval blockade of Cuba to force Khrushchev to get the missiles, the offensive weapons, out of Cuba to remove them. And I remember one of my one of the persons that I had gone to boarding school with, he joined the Navy right after graduation, and he was on one of the ships there, and they were made sure that the Kennedys got a lot of press out of that. And so that's what's happened on October 22nd. Seems like a big actress day. Now, we had the George Christopher interview. Unfortunately, I don't know what happened. I tried to upload it. But instead, since we're all thinking about government programs and we hear about massive deficits, in fact, in one of the interviews, we did a TV interview, which is still in the can. It can be broadcast. We haven't decided what to do with that. George Christopher died. And then did an audio interview, and I edited it down for several topics. But one of the things keeps the Democrats seem to be enjoying is this Bush bashing. And George Christopher, who died when he was 90, he had, did a lot of government service. Turns out that the first massive increase in the national budget was done by Bill Clinton, according to George Christopher. So we'll bring that up and how that happened. So that's coming, and then we'll try to bring the next week the interview with George Christopher. It's a long one, so it had to be edited. How the New York Giants were lured to San Francisco. This has never been revealed before, of all the things, the activities behind the scenes, weekend flights to New York, and how Los Angeles almost got a doubleheader. They ended up with the New York Dodgers. They were going to get the New York Giants. But and it's amazing what the deciding factor that Walter O'Malley that persuaded Walter O'Malley to move the New York Giants to San Francisco. Something very prosaic, and it also involves the UN in a different way. Let's see what else today. So since we are aware of programs and are concerned of what programs are going to be still in use. And there'll be access for people who need them. I'm going to replay, since as a substitute, Will Rogers' comment on government plans. What happened here?
Mayors in this country, there is not who shall be relieved and whose money shall relieve him, but who shall be the one that plays Santa Claus and actually hands out the presents, you know? That's the main part from the day, is who hands out the presents. Sure, he says, he should wear the whiskers. And if you can, Mr. Hopkins, they say no, we've got sleigh bells ourselves. Governor Talmadge, down in Georgia, he had a plan. It hit a rut and knocked him right out of the bread line last week. Been a bad week on plans all around. I'm not going to get discouraged, though. In fact, these other failures, well, they've given me confidence, you know? More hope that my plan will be a success. Now, my plan, to state it in a nutshell, and in fact, that's where all plans come from. And the nut should never be cracked. But here is my plan in a nutshell. My plan is a plan to end all plans. It's to do away with all plans. That's what it is. There ain't but one place that a plan is any good and that it'll really work, and that's on paper. But the minute you get it off a sheet of paper and get it out in the air and it blows away, that's what. Now, Mr. Roosevelt, he dragged more of these school marms out of little red schoolhouses. And they had.
That was cut loose, so. That we'll redo that one another time. Now, we'll go and discuss what some of the topics today. Now, one of the big items in the news is this whole business about don't ask, don't want to tell, or don't ask, don't tell. There's quite a bit of camouflage and smokescreen on this issue. Number one, this is it's black letter law that Congress and authorizes, creates the regulations, and if they are constitutional, don't violate anybody's rights, with exceptions, they're in effect, and they're mandated, and it's in the Code of Federal Regulations, Book 32, and it's in 10 U.S. Code. And, of course, I brought this up and others in the Steve Mary case and other cases involving the turnover of military personnel to local civilian authorities when civilian authorities accuse military personnel of violating local law or killing somebody or injuring somebody, whatever. Anyway, the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled on these issues in Chapel versus Wallace. And it was former governor of California, vice presidential nominee under for Dewey in 1948, and that was Earl Warren, Chief Justice of the United States, who wrote the opinion, and he said that military is a separate and distinct society, which it is, and only the Supreme Court can overrule itself. We can't have some judge down in Riverside or in Texas or New York or Boston, some federal judge, overruling the Supreme Court. We had this happen here, or defying the Supreme Court. It's happened in the Ninth Circuit here in San Francisco on this Steve Neri case, in which documents were forged, military mail certified to the San Francisco jail was destroyed, all kinds of violations, local authority violating federal law, and the district court here in San Francisco and the appellate court ignored these violations. And because the courts have been infiltrated by these sexual preference groups, it has no business, you know, political agendas, sexual preference agendas, any agenda has no business in the federal courts. They're just there to facilitate justice, facilitate the administration of the courts, and to follow the rules, and not to bring in your agendas. I remember when I worked in the federal courthouse, you couldn't wear political buttons, and another, in fact, they even frowned on putting political statements on your vehicle if you parked on government property. So I don't know what happened to that. We did have a thing called the Hatch Act, which was legislated in the late 1800s, I think, in the Hayes administration, because there was so much corruption that that went on in the Grant, President Grant's administration. So they came up with the Hatch Act that government employees, which clerks and staff attorneys in the federal court system are under. And there was a code of conduct. There apparently is no code of conduct for some of these state court employees. At least I haven't found one. Now, this whole business about open gays, lesbians, NAMBLAs, those who want the National Association of Man-Boy Love people to come on to military bases, and this has happened, and especially on some Marine bases, and they're just outraged because their children were allowed, they were allowed to have access to the school children who were dependents of military personnel serving overseas. Now, throughout history, there have been gays or homosexuals. There's a big fight about the terminology. As I said before, and those who are students of etymology, the origin of words and phrases, that up until the 60s, gay meant happy, carefree, happy-go-lucky person. I don't know how this term gay became a sexual preference term. But throughout history, throughout the whole since psychology and psychiatry and the study of human disorders, in the medical field, there's always been that term homosexual, and lesbian came in later. In fact, it's interesting that Queen Victoria said she didn't believe that women could be that way, or words to that effect. Yet she did have a son, supposedly the Duke of Clarence, who was allegedly Jack the Ripper. and some other strange things went on in the House of Windsor. But anyway, throughout history, there have been gays and homosexuals who have been military leaders. Julius Caesar and the Roman legions, they were out for a long time. I think service was 10 years for a legionnaire. But anyway, all the Roman historians who wrote about Julius Caesar remarked that he was a husband to his wife and a wife to his men. He was into that, and there was supposed to be a relationship with Brutus and maybe Mark Antony. Then there was Alexander the Great, one of the greatest generals of all time. He died when he was 33 years old. He had a bisexual relationship and one of his generals, And then there was a British admiral who was a doctor. The person was small. I've forgotten the person's name. Served on a ship. Nobody ever saw this person undress. When the person died, I think she was a rear admiral, they discovered she was a woman. So it's just fascinating when you're on one of those old sailing ships of the line in those days, and there was no privacy. But apparently she managed to obtain some and maintain it. Then we had in the late 1800s, in our own American Revolution, we had Baron von Frederick Augustus von Steuben, or von Steuben, and he was a Prussian, son of a Prussian nobleman. He was cashiered out of the Prussian army because he allegedly molested young boys. He tried to serve in the French and in other armies, and they rejected him. He came over during our American Revolution. He brought a young aide with him, a young man. We don't know about the relationship, although von Steuben never married. And he successfully trained the Continental Army. So he whipped it, in effect, into a fighting force, an effective fighting force. And there is no indication that he misbehaved while he was serving in training Washington's army. Now, there have been a few instances, and not talked about much, about homosexuality in the American Revolution among the Continental Army. Those of you who've seen the film Andersonville about the American Civil War, Andersonville was one of the worst prisons for POWs in the whole history of modern warfare. One of the reasons why this happened is because the South didn't have the resources to take care of our POWs. In fact, we had one up in Illinois called Camp Douglas, which was just as bad. And the North did have the resources to provide humane care for Confederate prisoners of war. But there were instances of homosexual assaults on young Union prisoners of war by other Union soldiers who were also POWs. And then Walt Whitman, the great poet, was gay or homosexual, and he nursed wounded prisoners, POWs, Confederate POWs, as well as Union prisoners who were in hospitals. He was a great friend of Lincoln. And one of the outrages in politics today is the Log Cabin Club claim that Abraham Lincoln was gay or homosexual because when he traveled, he slept with, shared a bed with Joshua Speed, who was his friend, and they were fellow lawyers. And anybody who knows anything and studied that period of history knows that there weren't Motel 5s or Holiday Inns or Hyatt Houses or Hilton Hotels or Sheraton Hotels in those days. And it was quite common to share a bed, two males or whatever. But according to the Log Cabin Club, there was a homosexual relationship, and they have intimated that Walt Whitman and Abraham Lincoln, when he was in the White House, there may have been something that happened. I mean, it's really spurious. But those of us who are critical of the Log Cabin Club think that if Lincoln were alive today and these people were spreading these malicious stories and historical misrepresentations, would Lincoln have said, "A house full of termites cannot stand"? That's how people view the Log Cabin Club, and they're the ones pushing this agenda. Now, in the late 1800s, around 1885, there was two notorious cases in Europe. There was the Colonel Radel, R-E-D-L, and there's a famous movie about him, and he was the head of Austrian military intelligence. He had a thing for young cadets and young Austrian soldiers. He was compromised and by the Russian military intelligence, and he was trading Austrian military secrets to the Russians, and the Russians and the Austrians were at each other's throats, which they were rivals, and this culminated in the incident at Sarajevo, because the Russians backed the Serbs and the Austrians Serbia was a province, territory of Austria, but the Austrian counterintelligence discovered Radel's treachery and compelled him to commit suicide. There's a famous play and there's a famous movie called Colonel Radel, R-E-D-L. In France, about that time, there was a Hungarian who somehow got into the French military, went to their military academy at Saint-Cyr, which is the equivalent of our West Point. And Esterhazy was his name, Count Esterhazy. And there was also a fellow officer, a wealthy family, Dreyfus. And Dreyfus was Jewish. He was standoffish. He was from Alsace-Lorraine, which the French had lost, that province, that eastern province in France, which France in the Franco-Prussian War, one of the fastest wars in history, lost that province to the Germans, or the Prussians. And Esterhazy needed money. He also ran a male whorehouse in Paris, and he was friendly with Oscar Wilde. Those of you who know Oscar Wilde, who was arrested and tried in Britain for sodomy with Lord Alfred Douglas, and he died in disgrace. Oscar Wilde was a great writer, and he was married, but he had these preferences. And Esterhazy needed money, so he was trying to sell French military secrets about a famous cannon. The French were famous for their light cannon. And remember that Napoleon was an artillery officer, and that they instilled that tradition in the French army, even up through World War One. I think it was the French 77. And we'll get into the connection of that cannon to San Francisco. We're putting together a video, and that'll be available. But anyway, the French counterintelligence discovered that there was a spy in the general staff. And since they were very anti-Semitic in the French army and in France, still to this day there's this anti-Semitism, Dreyfus, who was standoffish, who was a competent officer, who was the first Jew assigned to the French general staff, they were trying to find out who was the spy. And so, since he wasn't Catholic, or Huguenot, they focused on him. And Esterhazy set it up so that the suspicion was turned away from him to Dreyfus. And Dreyfus was railroaded. There was several infamous trials, and he was convicted of treason. He was offered a chance to commit suicide, which he didn't do. He maintained his innocence. He had the money to hire lawyers, but they still railroaded him in part because he was a Jew, and they railroaded him to Devil's Island. And it was a long, drawn-out fight, and Emile Zola, I'm not related, first thought Dreyfus was guilty, and then there was a lot of controversy about this case. The anti-Semitic French papers wanted to hang Dreyfus, and people like George Clemenceau, Anatole France said something's wrong here, and they kept the publicizing the fact that there was an injustice done by the general staff of the French military. The French Minister of War thought Dreyfus and insisted Dreyfus was guilty. And so this went back and forth, back and forth. Finally, they discovered that it was Esterhazy who was the spy. And then there was an infamous Major Henry who forged documents, very similar to the Steve Nery case, forging documents. And he was discovered, and they gave him a choice. And so he slit his throat. Dreyfus was finally exonerated. He survived. He served in World War One. A lot of careers were destroyed because of this awful spy case connected to homosexuality of one of the perpetrators. And then Dreyfus died just before World War II. Now, he is related, or the actor Richard Dreyfus, who's from Evanston, Illinois, is related to to Captain Alfred Dreyfus. I think he died, he was promoted to, because he was cashiered out, then he was reinstated in the French Army, and he died as a colonel, I believe. There's been some other cases of military personnel and diplomatic personnel in our time who were homosexuals, who were involved in treason. The most infamous cases are Philby, Kim Philby, and there were several British who diplomats who had gone to these universities and to practice the sexual preferences. They were left-wing communists, and they were involved with the Rosenbergs and Klaus Fuchs, German, in selling, stealing atomic secrets to the atom bomb, because the Russians, Stalin didn't have the secrets to manufacture an A-bomb. And Philby, McLean, and Burgess, and then the Queen's painter. He was gay, the official painter to Queen Elizabeth, all part of the spy ring, and they were all gay or bisexual. And they were involved in all kinds of selling British and American military secrets to the Russians, to Stalin. And that was a notorious case. And, of course, the Rosenbergs were not gay, were both executed, Julius and Ethel. And it's interesting because that case in and of itself, the Rosenberg federal trial, the way the U.S. Justice Department set it up was everybody was Jewish. The judge, Roy Cohn, was the prosecutor, and he died of AIDS. And I guess the jury was, there's a way to rig juries, as we'll get into another time. And the Rosenbergs were convicted. They were parents, had two young boys, and everybody, even the Pope, Pope Pius XII, said give them, pleaded with Harry Truman, his president, to grant them life in prison instead of executing them. But Truman said no. They put the country at risk, and they were executed. Their cousin, David Greenglass, he was also involved with stealing atomic bomb secrets, and then it was quite a bit. Now, there's also a famous FBI film, House on 97th Street. It's about how the Germans and the Nazis in World War II tried to steal the secrets of to make the atom bomb, because a lot of the work was being done at Oak Ridge, Tennessee. And this is fairly accurate, that the head of the German spy ring was a transvestite, a woman who dressed as a man, Mr. Christopher. Now, he's not related to George Christopher, by the way. And it's a famous film, and we'll show a clip from it on our Amicus Veritas YouTube site. Since we are educational, and we can do that. Now, in recent times, there was another notorious spy case in Britain called a naval captain named Vassal. He was homosexual and selling military secrets to the communists. And then just recently, in the last few months, we've had at least two major cases with our U.S. Navy. One, this guy Timothy Manning, who was his mother was British and his father was an American serviceman. He was gay since he was 13. There are questions of how did he get into the U.S. Army. He's the guy who's been leaking all of these military secrets about Afghanistan and Iraq to WikiLeaks and all these other people, and it is considered that he has committed treason, and he's put a lot of people at risk, and we understand there's more that's coming out, and the reason his motives for doing it was because he was opposed to Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And then there was another case of a naval sailor, U.S. Navy sailor, who was on a submarine, and you're not supposed to bring cameras or recording devices or anything when you're in secure facilities, secure areas like communications, that sort of thing, for obvious reasons. He brings his flip or whatever, his little digital camera, and he left it around. Somebody found it and found pictures on it that he was involved in homosexual activity. So he's been charged, but I think he was forced out. And he's complaining that he's being picked on because he's gay. Well, he violated the naval regulations. You're not supposed to bring that type of equipment on the ship or the submarine. I think he's on a submarine. And then, this is a security problem. And nobody knew he was gay or homosexual. So now he's using that as a front and as opposition to Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And the Steve Nary case, and Jack Cashel did part of it. Jack Cashel, the great investigative editor, He's written several books. He does a book a year. We gave him material for his book, What's the Matter with California? And damn it, there's a lot. Anyway, he got into part of the Neri case, the Steve Neri case, who was a youth who was lured, drugged, and raped by a neo-Nazi Argentinian who's from a famous family in Buenos Aires, the Pifferé family, connected to the famous bank down there. Anyway, during his illegal trial, kangaroo court trial here in San Francisco 10 years ago, they put the U.S. Navy and the U.S. Marine Corps on trial as homophobic. And this was done, of all people, by a guy who entered the country under suspicious circumstances from Canada, a guy named Kevin Ryan, named in a living infamy. And the prosecutor was a homophile, Terrence Hallinan, and one of his assistants, a guy named Farrell, who injected gay bathhouses near a high school where Steve Neri had gone to high school, and claimed that Steve Neri was a closet homosexual who had killed this guy because he was ashamed of himself. But anyway, Jack Paschal gets into part of the trial. We gave him the documents for that. But there's a lot more. But anyway, I suggest you get Jack Paschal's book, because there's anybody who's concerned about the future of this state, just to digress here, should read What's the Matter with California, because there are a lot of issues in that book. For instance, to digress, why the cost of housing has been so high in this state. And one of the reasons, and Jack Paschal had worked for HUD-funded housing authority back east, one of the reasons is we have these planners and these politically motivated administrators and building departments who over-regulated the construction industry and made it so expensive and prohibitive to build affordable housing. So what do people who want to build affordable housing? It becomes so costly and the regulations and the building codes become so restrictive that they just leave the state. It's not worth it. So that's one of the reasons. And then the people who impose these restrictions have their own political agenda. They have an agenda, but they have little ability and even less experience. But I recommend that book, What's the Matter with California? The other thing is that the issue that the military is, getting back to the don't ask, don't tell, it's going to be very interesting that how we balance the security interests and the rights of servicemen. Servicemen do have rights, but there are a lot of restrictions. They have rights as well as responsibilities. And this whole business of sexual preference really doesn't belong in the public arena. And there's the other issue that nobody's looking at. How is it that we have all these high-ranking officers who are retired, who said, well, I was gay while I was in the service? Well, how could they have served? And they've served honorably, got their veterans benefits, educational benefits, whatever. And they apparently didn't politicize their sexual and publicize their sexual preference. So something's wrong there. They survived. And what we have, this crowd, these propagandists who want to flaunt their sexual preference, politicize it. It doesn't belong there. The other thing is, something's going to have to be done about this issue, and it's been suggested by several people that if people want to be openly gay and lesbian and in the military services, then maybe they should be segregated. I hate to use the phrase, but that may be a possible solution. On the one hand, we don't want to lose talented, capable people, but you just can't have this kind of dissension in the ranks. And so we'll see where that goes. We shall see what we shall see, as one of our political pundits has said. Now, another interesting thing, I'll digress, is the Juan Williams controversy with NPR and the Public Broadcasting Company, because that is associated with PBS. Having been in public radio myself, and having been, quote, politically incorrect, raising a lot of issues that really don't belong in public radio as part of the programming, but when people like myself had raised these issues, eventually we got forced out. And I was curious about Juan Williams. Always been curious about him. He has good titled books, Eyes on the Prize, things like that. But there seems to be more to this controversy with him and Vivian Schiller. I don't know who the hell she is. At NPR. And some of the blogs that are coming out from other journalists are raising issues about him tolerating a lot of this stuff and knowing that this agenda went on in NPR. And here, what's interesting is I didn't know that he's a Panamanian, born in Colon, Panama. And it'd be interesting to see during his career when the John McCain issue came up, because John McCain was born in the Canal Zone when it was under the authority of the United States, when we controlled it. And there was an issue when John McCain ran for the U.S. Senate, for president, whether he was, according to the Constitution, a natural-born U.S. citizen, because he was born in what was not a U.S. state, which was the Canal Zone, the Panama Canal Zone. And so he disclosed all the records, unlike Mr. O, who spent $1 million, or his people spent $1 million to block access, public access to birth certificates and law school records and all of that. And so we've got that controversy, and of course Juan Williams is known as a liberal. But what has happened here in public radio, when you weren't politically correct in San Francisco, for instance, the program director of KLW, Ted Samuel, old San Francisco family, served in World War II, served in Patton's army. He helped liberate Mauthausen concentration camp. He studied at the Pasadena Playhouse, and I think one of his teachers was Victor Jory, who legally immigrated to the United States from the Yukon Territory, which is the farmost territory of Canada, or province, excuse me. Their provinces are like our states. And anyway, Jory came down here and served in the Coast Guard during World War One. He had a great baritone voice, and he was also in the movie Gone with the Wind. He played the evil overseer, and I got to see that film again. Like, I forgot. And he was also the Shadow, not the new Shadow, but one of the original Shadows. But anyway, we have this issue about political correctness, which is what this is. And I've noticed that throughout, when I was in public radio at KLW and Western Public Radio, we used to listen to Canadian Broadcasting and carry their feeds, and BBC, British Broadcasting, and NPR, National Public Radio, and I think Nina Totenberg and others at that network have overstepped the line on the same issue that they accuse Juan Williams of doing, and maybe even worse. But the whole other people are saying, well, he profited from it, but I look at it this way. It's a situation where, in his favor, adversity has turned to a great advantage. He's got a $2 million three-year contract from Fox. That's a lot more money than NPR was paying him, and I don't know if they had that long a contract with him. So, you know, a lot of people saying, well, what are you crying about? And, of course, you know, this is an interesting aspect of a person who is a liberal becomes a conservative after he's been mugged. Well, I'll phrase it this way. It seems that a liberal in media, after being shafted by his federal liberals, learns that there are conservative values and issues and which are of value and relevant and should be allowed in the whole arena for among this discourse of ideas. I'm getting a little hoarse here because it's a longer program than I had planned. Now, Justice Scalia, I call him one of the incandescent intellects in the U.S. whole federal court system. Good writer. Now, he put out a book, which I recommend that people read, because, as I've said repeatedly, based on my own experience in federal courthouse, that the judiciary on all levels is the least reported on, the least known, and is virtually nothing or very little known about the judges, or even less about the staff attorneys and the clerks and the clerk of court of these courts. Yet they've become they've been infiltrated and subverted for political agendas. Legal papers have been reporting that, for instance, at the U.S. Supreme Court, there were at least 26 gay clerks. Now, you know, that there is a federal code of ethics for court clerks. I would think that this would be verboten, this kind of political preference brought into the courts. And this Steve Nery's case, it came up, and I was told when I did the filing for him that this case is going nowhere, quote-unquote, and it was from one of these gays. In the gay marriage issue here in California in the state Supreme Court, there was an article in one of the legal papers about the gay lawyers who have infiltrated the court, and this is where that agenda is coming from, because these judges have big dockets. Some have bigger dockets than others, and some get through them very quickly. Some of them rely more and more on their clerks and staff attorneys. And so these are the gatekeepers, and they determine if the judge is not, you know, overwhelmed or gives too much leeway and too much allows these people to do all kinds of things and make decisions and in effect write the briefs when they're supposed to research them. There's a difference. We get these kind of agendas and these kind of findings. And people get very upset and blame the judge and say the judge is legislating from the bench, when in fact we've had the clerks and staff attorneys who have put this thing together. I mean, it's their agenda, not necessarily that judge. I don't know what Judge Phillips down there in Riverside, who the court clerks were, and nobody up here that I know have seen that her brief that was written for her on the basis of formulating her decision. This is going to be interesting. But this is what goes on. And Scalia said in his book that, and this is known to us who have been in the legal field, that the law firms and lawyers, before they have a case that's coming up for trial or hearing before a judge, they do research or have research done on that judge. And it was Roy Cohn who made this statement, "Don't tell me about the case, tell me who the judge is." So in a way, that's how he dealt with, and he was a very good lawyer, even though he's crooked as hell. So there's that issue. So you've got to know, you know, whether you're in probate court or small claims court, you need to find out these things. And of course, they do switch judges around and things get switched around. But at least you shouldn't go in there walking blind and deaf and not knowing anything about the court that you're going into, whether it's a small claims, whether it's a probate, whether it's a traffic court. You know, you need to know about these people. And some of them are very efficient, they're very fair, very ethical, and we need more of those people. But ignorance is not bliss, that's one of my sayings, and I recommend that, you don't shortchange yourself because you were too lazy to check on who's this judge. And this information, this biographical information, is available. It's public record. So it's up to you, especially if you're going into court, like a probate hearing, find out who the judge is, find out all the little peculiarities about that person. You don't want to tick the person off or have your lawyer tick them off or whatever. So check these things out, especially if you have a heavy-duty case, and ask your lawyer, does he know who he's going to be trying a case or a hearing before? Now, and we got into why the housing was so expensive. Now, another issue that's cropped up is, this is the an East Bay paper called East Bay Express, or as critics call it, the Depressed. It's an Oakland, California paper, which was tied into New Times of Phoenix, Arizona, that chain, which is also owned by Village Voice, or was, out of New York. Anyway, they printed an article, which is very important in getting back to housing, that the Oakland police are alleged to have used building inspectors to enter a person's house. And there's certainly a question about this because it's warrantless entry and there's no justification in a lot of these cases. There's only suspicion. And there is the right to be safe in our houses and in our person. It's still that constitutional protection. And so there's a question about this type of activity. And the Oakland police have had a very bad reputation going back several decades. They used to hire Oakland policemen from the Deep South because they had a black population and they wanted to keep the blacks, in, quote, in their place, as I was once told by how things go on across the bay. We're talking about Oakland, California. And some of that's changed, but they seem to be trigger-happy. You get into a lot of problems. It's not only the transit cop case, a guy named Mercily, who claimed that on that New Year's night, wasn't 2 years ago, that he reached for his taser and mistakenly pulled out his gun and pulled the trigger and found it wasn't a taser, but put a bullet in a young man's head and killed him. And so there was riots over in Oakland, people were very upset in the black community and neighborhoods. And Mercily was convicted of second-degree murder. He's appealing that case. And here, this guy is a transit cop, for BART in Oakland, California. I'm a little hoarse. But these things go on. And then recently, they had Oakland police that were called to a house in one of the neighborhoods. And there was an old dog there, about 10 years old, and the cop killed it. And the people are upset. It was not a pit bull or any protection dog, Rottweiler or what have you, or German Shepherd. And the people are furious. And, their police have got to come up with standards and training for policemen to deal with dogs. In fact, the San Francisco police, police chief Gascon, he emigrated from Cuba when he was 14. Interesting guy. Served in the U.S. Army. Went to night law school down. He wants to be police chief of L.A. Everybody knows that. He seems to be an all right guy. Anyway, he has announced that he is making sure that San Francisco police officers learn how to, if they don't know already, how to deal with dogs. That just because you got a badge doesn't mean that the dog recognizes it. So, I'm sorry about the George Christopher Giants, luring the Giants to San Francisco. I don't know what happened. I tried to upload it. So, since I'm going hoarse, I'm going to, what should we do? Oh, I wanted to play this. One of the great American closers who a lot of people still don't know, was his birthday this week, and so I had scheduled it until we had problems. I don't know if you, how many of you are using Yahoo, but he was a great composer, and he went to Yale, which had a good music school, and he made his fortune in selling insurance, but he wrote music on the side. And here's one of his marches called They Are Here. Thank you. was introduced to Charles Ives with the 1962, I think it was, Leonard Bernstein's Young People's Concerts. He played Charles Ives' music, and that was the introduction. In fact, I didn't even know him in music school. But I thought that would be a little interesting. And he's written a lot of music. He died in 1954, and he's an American original, American composer, who sold insurance in the daytime and wrote music at night. Also, this week, Tom Bosley died. Tom Bosley was from Chicago, and he was, in his later career as an actor, he was in some TV series, excuse me, my voice is going, but he was in the 50s Broadway show Fiorello, after Fiorello and LaGuardia, and that's our theme, Politics and Poker, which was based on the life of Fiorello and LaGuardia. And so we'll close out tonight, since my voice is going, with our favorite ending theme, Politics and Poker, which is what a lot of politics, the term smoke-filled room, especially was used about President Harding, who was also a senator, and he wasn't a lawyer, he was a newspaper publisher. And the 1920 election, one of the few elections in American history where none of the candidates were lawyers, and it was the only election in American history where all of the candidates for the presidency were either, it was a journalist from Philadelphia Inquirer, I think it was, and the two publishers, Cox and Harding, were publishers of newspapers in Ohio. And we'll get into, Harding had a great voice from a radio perspective, and he was also the first president who was supposed to have Negro blood. That was the term used at the time. And when he was accused of this, he says, "I can't help it if one of my ancestors jumped over the back fence." And there's a lot more on Harding, and I think he's going to be rehabilitated as history, as time goes on, because he was also working for disarmament. Fascinating guy, and he's the guy who created the Bureau of the Budget, did quite a few things, and his first president to really use the radio. So we'll end with this tribute to Tom Bosley. Where is it?
Say, Ben, want a hand?
No, you guys go ahead. I got too much on my mind to play poker.
King bets.
Cost you five. Tony, up to you.
Hey, Tony, what are you going to do?
I'm in.
So am I.
Likewise.
Me too. Gentlemen, here we are, and one thing is clear. We gotta pick a candidate for Congress this year.
Big ace.
Ace bet.
You'll pay through the nose.
Okay, where do you stand?
I'm in.
So am I.
Likewise.
Here goes.
Possible straight, possible flush. Nothing.
Gentlemen, how about some names we can use? Some qualified Republican who's willing to lose.
We don't want any qualified Republicans to lose, or Democrats who are really serving the country and not themselves. So go to our Amicus Veritas YouTube site and amicusveritas.org. We'll see you next week. You'll get my voice back. It's Peter Paul Brizola. Thank you for listening. Okay.